store. We're gonna bomb our way to freedom with the cruise missiles of justice and the spent shells of democracy. Oh, say, can you see? From Kabul to Khartoum, where Allah's martyrs bled, to the Iraqi desert, 200,000 people dead. We're gonna bomb our way to freedom. It's been an exciting couple of months with the new administration there. Everything seems to be a lot like it was before, only a little sped up. Yeah. To the tunnels beneath Hanoi, from Tulsa to El Chorizo, fat man to little boy. We fought them in Nicaragua and upon the Cuban shore. Killed Gaddafi's daughter. See what the fatwas got in store. We're gonna bomb our way to freedom with the cruise missiles of justice and the spent shells of democracy. Oh, say, can you see? From Kabul to Khartoum, where Allah's martyrs bled, to the Iraqi desert, 200,000 people dead. We're gonna bomb our way to freedom with the cruise missiles of justice and the spent shells of democracy. Oh, say, can you see?
To Bathurst Spears Broadsides. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. And if one playthrough is good, well, hopefully two playthroughs is even better. That's David Robix, of course, and always glad to hear him in the studio. Sometimes hear a bit too much of him, but it's good to have him around. And I hope you're around this evening. This is, as I said, Bathrop's Piers Broadsides. It's Civil Rights Outside, and we're going to be doing this April 4th show from 6 to 8 as usual. I'm your host, Robert Norris. And I'm kind of winging the show because I'm just back from San Francisco with the new Street Spirit and Street Sheet newspapers, which are the papers that homeless people sell on the streets for a buck. And in this issue, they've got an interesting article on Santa Cruz by yours truly, not only looking forward to the upcoming Right to Sleep Summit or Homeless Summit or Sleeping Band Summit, as it's been alternately called, but also describing some victories for homeless people in the last month, 2 months. Small victories, teeny tiny victories, but call them victories anyway. And you can read all about that in the Street Spirit and Street Sheet newspapers just by kicking down a buck to one of your local homeless folks who's selling those on the streets. And that's a good way for people to get out of the cold, get out of the rain, avoid the hassles and dangers of the sleeping ban and blanket bans, which make it illegal to either sleep or cover up with blankets after 11 o'clock at night in Santa Cruz under the municipal code. So you might think about that when you see folks selling that paper on the streets. And if you can't find a copy, you can always give a call to a distributor, Becky Johnson. She's at 429-8529, and you can get a paper from her. And actually, the lead story is also available in the Santa Cruz Comic News. It's in the green press section, most of it anyway. Looks like a few items have been cut out, and we're going to be talking about that a little bit later, probably. But that's if you haven't got any money at all and you just want to take a look at the Santa Cruz Comic News, which is always fun to look at. Green Press is always a good read. Lots of interesting international stuff, and occasionally it's got some, well, increasingly some domestic, and I should say even local stuff, which is what interests me, because it's, well, I remember trying to, I called into Helen Caldicott yesterday. Vinny was doing an interview with her on free radio, and really hard to get people to direct their attention to local reactions, even to national issues. I was trying to get her reading on whether this gloomy picture that I hear from my contacts in New York City and Los Angeles are true, that there's this incredible continuing war fervor support for the Bush administration. And I don't, it's hard for me to believe. Maybe I'm just, you know, we're living in a bubble here in Santa Cruz to some extent. It's kind of a strange hypocritical bubble where people are very anti-Bush, but the politicians are also very anti-homeless, and basic civil rights is something that people like to talk about for folks far away, but do nothing about for folks who are local. And I'm talking not about activists who are always, I think, trying to work for local folks, as well as dealing with far away issues, but the politicians that run the city and the bureaucrats and the folks in the police department and the folks in the mainline churches and the conservative organizations that, or even the liberal organizations that supposedly provide social services and so forth. Unfortunately, it falls to those of us who are not in those groups, just concerned about the issues, to do what we need to do to make the changes that need to be made, whether it's decriminalizing medical marijuana and insisting that the city council pass emergency resolutions like other cities have done, which this city council steadfastly refuses to do, so driving the larger medical marijuana club completely out of business and overloading WHAM, the smaller one, whether it means strong protests and demonstrations to reassert community control of police so we once more, or perhaps for the first time, can regain some control over our police department, essentially ignoring the Citizens Police rah-rah board and the other fig leaves the city council puts out as a sort of a decoy, as a cover, as a public relations exercise, as a sort of a sop to liberals who think that the CPRB actually has some power, is doing something meaningful, or is a real process. I'll be talking about the CPRB later, too, because they have their monthly meeting on Monday, and actually a CPRB meeting member came to our meeting, our Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom Huff meeting, which meets every Wednesday at Baker Square in the morning at 8:30 on Ocean Street, and actually encouraged us to come to the Citizens Police Review Board meeting just to see what was going on and to provide some input on violations of civil rights by the police in terms of homeless people and poor people, if we had that information, economic profiling as it's called. And again, we're going to be talking about that as well. Talking about a lot of stuff today, and I hopefully will also be able to engage in some dialogue with anybody out there who wants to discuss any of these issues or has their own issues to raise around what's going on the streets, what's going on for poor folks. There's actually was a rent rally in Monterey today. Actually, it's happening right now, I believe. And hopefully I'll get a report from someone who's been down there for the Sunday show. The show returns on Sunday from 10 to 1:30 in the afternoon. And you'll be able to tune it in there. And we can give you the update on how things went. It'd be nice if we had some renter power rallies here in Santa Cruz. And not just something, you know, led by Eric Larson with a political objective in the Beach Flats, or designed to support a particular political campaign for city council, or to push Mercy Charities Housing's latest a boondoggle project, but that actually concerned and pushed for real rent control citywide, which is what we need, or countywide, actually, or maybe even getting more to the roots of it, a rent strike for all of us. That's been pushed by some more militant folks and discussed. People have talked about putting together, we're talking about a Right to Sleep Summit coming up May 3rd and 4th here in Santa Cruz, and that's definitely on the agenda and coming together, and people are invited to it. But what about a renters summit? You know, that would be a nice thing for someone out there to start to organize, a vital thing, a necessary thing, so we can establish the kind of connections and power and communication and political pressure that we need to change things here in Santa Cruz. This is an election year, so of course that means you're going to get a whole lot of bullshit coming your way, from the politicians, probably going to get the recycled gang coming back, Rotkin, Byers, Matthews, those scan politicians who did their scanning and scamming back in the 90s, and they'll be back with us again, all eager to jump on the council after the screw-ups of Fitzmaurice, Crone, Sugar, Porter, and Riley, which are, of course, monumental, and now will be being taken to court in this federal lawsuit, which I've been lucky enough to get legal support for and was filed on March 26th. Hey, we got a call-in number here if you want to get in touch, 427-3772, and to get us rolling here, I'm going to be playing an interview I did as I drove south, stopped in Big Sur at the Henry Miller Memorial Library. That's just south of Big Sur as you head down, was heading down to Los Angeles to help a friend with a police brutality case. And this is an interview with a man named Magnus who talks about poor people in Big Sur and thereabouts, and also in Sweden, which is where he hails from. So check this out and call in.
You've been around for how long?
Since '84.
So you've got a sense of how poor people are treated, homeless people, transient folks.
Yeah, I do. And of course, in my wife came in 1972. She was 18. And the huge change, of course, I think happened when, in late 60s and early 70s, Big Sur, for better or worse, was a huge hangout for hippies at that time. And in the canyons up and down here, the Five State Park, along the beach, along the riverbeds, people were living back to nature kind of a thing. And you know, that's a whole long story. But
did they respect the environment, or was there a lot of trashing? What was the situation like then?
I wasn't here, but what I hear is that they did not respect the environment at all, in fact. So that it was, kind of like, I sometimes take, the famous picture after Woodstock, you know, when they shoot the arena or shoot the fields after they're all gone. Not as bad as that.
Trashed out, right.
Trashed out, right. So, and they had actually, I think they had nitrogen content at the river delta that was elevated due to so much people doing it in the river, yeah. And just the quantity of people. But then the whole attitude of, you know, I came down in 78 the first time and hitchhiked down the coast. I never had to wait longer. Sometimes I say this, of course, it's not quite true, but I feel it's close to the truth. I rarely waited longer than the car that I just had gotten a ride from lets me off before that car is out of sight.
And because of your handsome good looks, right?
No. It's because of the time. Of course, I'm sure it was a little bit easier to be Caucasian and whatever, but I think it was a completely different story then, in terms of how people took care of each other in that sense. So,
The homeless made the headlines, and there was an upsurge in the 80s and, of course, into the 90s. And has there been a significant tightening of attitudes, or people who sleep in their vehicles, for example, and I'm talking about low-income type vehicles, or in their cars, are they harassed? I've seen signs that come south that says county camping ordinance, no sleeping or camping. I guess it's no camping.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's enforced stricter now than it was before. People are not allowed to stay in their cars. Although, you know, there are a few people that are managing to do it. I'm not exactly sure how it works, sort of some informal way, but...
Is the Big Sur Lucia community open to folks coming in, or is it sort of cliquey and closed? What's the situation down?
Oh, I don't know. It's a tough one. You know, it's changed so much, and the land values here are high. Most people have neighbors that are very, very wealthy, people are caretakers.
It's all free. No.
Yeah, you know, I gotta go. I gotta take care of business so I can pay my rent.
All right. So, what are you going to be playing for us here?
It's a song that I've found when I started this job in long time ago, eight years ago, I guess, there was a tape laying in the library, an old cassette tape, and on it was this song, and I thought it was too cool. So and there was a phone number on the cassette, so I called the phone number up and found that it was written and performed by a guy named Dan Byrne. And subsequently, I've learned that Dan Byrne has a lot under his, you know.
He's a local?
Consummate traveling troubadour, really. I mean, I think he grew up in Iowa. And then, you know, he was in Los Angeles for a short while with record companies and those kind of things, but then he didn't like that so much, so he went back to his road thing. And he's an incredible songwriter, kind of in the rough, how do you describe him? He tells beautiful, long stories with his songs, and oftentimes they are incredibly funny at the same time, so.
Balladeer, perhaps.
Balladeer, yeah. Pretty, can be rough on the edges, he can be.
With a perverse, twisted sense of humor.
Yeah.
As you're about to discover.
So this is a song, this obvious a song for this place, then.
Tuning up here as we take in the sunshine at the Henry Miller Memorial Library, just south of Big Sur.
Not quite in tune, but that's okay. You can dance.
Marilyn Monroe didn't marry Henry Miller. 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 But if she did, he'd have taken her to Paris. And if she did, she'd have dyed her hair blue. And if she did, she'd have smoked a lot of opium. And if she did, she may be alive. Oh, 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 Henry Miller. Oh, 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 Marilyn Monroe. Marilyn Monroe didn't marry Henry Miller. She lived outside of Tropic of Capricorn. Marilyn Monroe didn't marry Henry Miller. And I don't even know if she knew Henry Miller. But if she did, he'd have taken her to Paris. And if she did, she'd have taken her to Paris. And let's see. Best line in the song. And if she did, he'd have taken her to Paris. And if she did, they'd have fucked every day. And if she did, she'd have felt like a woman and not like a photograph in a magazine. Oh, whoa, whoa, Henry Miller. Oh, whoa, whoa, Marilyn Monroe. This is not a knock against Arthur Miller. Death of a Salesman is my favorite play. But Marilyn Monroe should have married Henry Miller. And I don't even know if she knew Henry Miller. But if she did, he'd have taken her to Paris and tied her to the bed and eaten dinner off of her. And okay, maybe she'd have died the same anyway. But if she did, she would have had more fun.
Whoa. And that was by
Dan Byrne.
And sung by
Magnus Torrin.
Thank you, Magnus.
One of those things that in the last 20 years, the land values have just gone up and up and up, just like in Santa Cruz. And here you have the land use plan, you know, protecting the environment for a good reason. There are several places that are, you know, put in scenic easement forever, where you don't have public access other than visual access. I mean, people are only going to look at these places. They are going to be in perpetuity, theoretically at least, preserved the way they are, which I think is a good thing, because, you know, the Big Sur River, Little Sur River Delta, for instance. If I can imagine just have my grandchildren or whatever stand there in 50 years and it looks the same, would be a great thing. And that the only way that can happen is if you don't allow any public access there, you know, because if you do, then you have to build
parking lanes and parking lots and ramps and rails and, you know, to accommodate safe public access.
But access to the beaches, I know that was an issue up and down there, you know, there seems to be in Santa Cruz, the rich property owners have sort of staked out these, you know, all along the cliffs of Capitola and Santa Cruz, but you still have, the public has the right to use the beaches, you know, like the high water mark or some such thing. That's true down here, right?
No, it's not true here. And it's not true here either that there are fairly few beaches that are, you know, accessible from anywhere on land. Either the cliffs are too steep or the beach, right, you know, there are so few, so there aren't that many beaches really. It's rocky coast, most of it. So the beaches that are here are most of them publicly accessible by trails going down to them. So I don't think that there are hardly any beaches that are owned and sort of protected by a private landowner, that they have the only access to it. And of course the law provides for, I think, you can come paddle on a surfboard or you can come in from the ocean side and legally access the beach that way.
I think there's also now a provision because of the Coastal Act, I'm not sure about this, that the property owners have to provide some kind of access to the public beaches, but you say there are very few of them here.
Right, very few. There are, you know, there's Pfeiffer Beach and there's the Garapata beaches and it's Sand Dollar Beach and a few others that are accessible, and they are pretty much the same in terms of accessibility as they've always been. The only thing, the federal government has implemented the charge to get to Pfeiffer Beach. You have to pay, I think it is $5 now for your, you know, I don't even know exactly.
Unless you paddle in, of course.
Unless you paddle in, right. But anyway, so it's tough here in terms of how to deal with, you know, the people that run businesses in Big Sur have a difficult time finding people to work for them because it's expensive to live here with the transportation going up and down from Monterey, and it's very expensive usually to find a place to live because many landowners are just like it is, you know, the supply is low and demand is high, so people are charging
similar to Santa Cruz where they, you know, they pay shit wages to people,
right.
Yet they, you know, they can't afford their housing costs, so they just they commute in from Watsonville and these places where they live in, you know, couple of families in small apartments, many of them illegal immigrants from Guatemala, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Mexico, who work very hard,
yep.
You know, to do the work that, you know, that they, I guess it requires that for them to be able to pay the rent they have. But I'm just wondering, and I guess I assume that it's even worse here because it's such a scenic, tourist-ish type scene. I mean, you don't have any domestic industry except tourism.
Right, exactly. And the other thing, the difference here also is that makes it, for me personally, I wouldn't want the businesses here, for instance, to go to the county and say we need to build staff housing, and because there are very limited space to build anything here on the coast, and of course the regulations are there to prevent the coast from being over-established as far as residency and all of the services that would come along with that. So the primary reason for the land use plan for this area, specifically Big Sur area, was to preserve the rural and wild character of this area. And so there are several prices you have to pay for that, I think. And one of them is that businesses here will have to adapt their size, their operation, to the amount of staff housing that they have, or that they can, you know, reasonably establish, and not grow beyond those boundaries, so that they have, I mean, because one of the main qualifications for someone to come to look for a job here, let's say if you, Robert, went up to one of the bigger businesses here and said, I want a job, their first question oftentimes would be, perhaps not literally, but basically this is what it is, they say, do you have a place to live? And if you say, yes, I do, then, so well, what do you want to do? There are several things you can do here. And so that is the issue.
How are the wages? Are the wages, you know, like $8 an hour or something? Or are they, there's nowhere near a living wage, I assume.
It's tough, just because of the price of most of the rentals around here, it's pretty tough to live on what you would get paid in Santa Cruz. I think that a gardener or someone who cleans brush, does fire clearance, gets quite a bit more here than they do in Santa Cruz. I don't know.
Like how much would a waitress get? Do you actually have waitresses here? Do people do their own waitressing at their own businesses?
No. Yeah, waitresses and waiters, but they, of course, it totally depends on where you work. There are some places in Big Sur where it's very high-end.
Like
high-end.
How much per hour would you ask?
I don't know. They probably make at least $25 an hour, $30 an hour. You know, because
wow.
that's because of the
with
tips.
Yeah. Right.
It's because of the tips. I mean, that's why. I mean, a waiter, of course, is completely dependent on how big the bill is.
Right. So, I guess I wanted to ask Brian, who's wandering back here. Brian, you're up in the Monterey area, right? As well,
Carmel
area. What's the situation for the workers up there? I mean, most of the people who work in Carmel, do they live there or do they live like elsewhere?
Outside of town.
And is that a problem for the businesses in Carmel, or is it sort of work out because there's sufficient low-income housing in Seaside?
There isn't sufficient low-income housing. I mean, the whole county, that's the major problem. The big issue with, the overall Economic Development Commission, of which I'm a member of in Monterey County, the biggest issue has to do with land planning that can create affordable housing for people that are employed here. And it's pretty much impossible to do. So we've kind of come to the conclusion that there isn't a such thing as overall economic development. It comes more down to how do you maintain an economic climate that can allow for people that are already here to have quality lives.
Now, is the main business in the Monterey Peninsula area, it's tourism, or are there other alternate business? It used to be the Army, too, right?
Okay, it used to be Army was like 30%. A third of it was the Army, the military, a third of it was tourism, and a third of it was agriculture. And so that shifted some because the military presence is not what it used to be with Fort Ord gone, although, you know, we have the Defense Language Institute, the Naval Postgraduate School, which are, you know, world-renowned and major, you know.
How about the university? Is the university, or the state college, what's happening with that?
Well, it's very, very small, you know, so, yeah, there are, I don't know.
1,000 people?
Perhaps. I'm not sure. I think they're envisioning 10 to 15,000 students, but that's probably 10 or 15 years away.
There was some talk of using all this unused or abandoned housing in Fort Ord either for homeless folks or for just low-income housing. What happened to that idea?
I think it has to do with bringing all of the housing up to code and asbestos in the buildings and things of that nature. I've not really studied the issue, but I know that that'll all be raised. I mean, none of the old housing.
Real candidates claims that I think in the last decade, the houses they built, 800 houses, and they're all $800,000 a piece or something. There's some very high-end focus for building in Santa Cruz County. Is that the case? What's perspective, you know, what's foreseen for this Fort Ord housing?
That wouldn't be the case at Fort Ord. One of the things is, you have people from all over the world want to live here that already have their wealth.
Right.
So you come here and it isn't a matter how much money you want to spend. The interesting thing is in development they're supposed to be provided, and I'm new to all of this, but I think it was stated that 20% affordable housing. How do you define affordable housing? I mean, it should be affordable for everybody somehow. And 80% of the residents of Monterey County could not afford to buy a home.
That sounds like family.
You know, so how do you do that? You've got 20% affordable housing you're to create when you've got 80% of your population cannot afford to buy a home. And for the working class people, I mean, even if you're earning a median income of $80,000 a year for a household of two, doesn't afford to buy you a home here.
Yeah, there was the Street Spirit newspaper talks about California as the meanest streets in the U.S., but there was also an article recently in the New York Times which talked about Santa Cruz County being the least affordable county in the country. And I thought, wow, I mean, less affordable than Marin County, less affordable than Beverly Hills. I guess it's Los Angeles County, so it includes other, you know, or I don't know, Westchester County or something in New York. What's happening here in Monterey County in terms of, I'm thinking of the westward side of Monterey County, the coastal side, I guess there probably is affordable housing in Salinas and some of the areas where folks are working.
Well, not really by definition.
Really? Even there
too? Yeah, I mean, it's tough. Actually, they had And since I'm relatively new to this, I'm not quick to bring up the numbers and statistics, but the Overall Economic Development Commission has put together a jobs housing forum, to which this is a big element that they're studying with the economic development, and it'd be fascinating. I mean, if you wanted to learn about that, you could go to the Monterey County Overall Economic Development Commission and get the all of the information that they've compiled, and follow that as they do the studies on how to create a job, you know, housing balance. So, you know, you could have people that are working class people that can afford, you know, to live here and provide the services that are necessary. I mean, it's basically comes down to how do you maintain a quality life.
Well, I guess, I mean, my prejudice, and I'm not here, so my thought is being sort of a, I don't know how you put it, but since you do have all this wealth rolling in all the time, there isn't a lot of concern as to, you know, I guess there is some concern, there must be, as to how to keep people, how do you get good health, you know, that sort of thing.
No, there's tremendous concern for that.
Right.
It's not that there's not tremendous concern for that, but then also, there, I mean, it's the economics of it. I mean, you can't just artificially create something, you know, otherwise that's tax people's dollars, and then that comes out of, I mean, me and him, our wages, to be able to supply housing for other people when, I mean, how do you fight that? How do you deal with that? That's...
Has there been any attempt to look at other countries, like, let's say in Europe, and how they've dealt with these situations? Because you're on some sort of commission, you were saying?
Yeah, yeah.
And has there been any kind of, you know, comparison?
There are models for high-density planned unit developments that involve mixed use, to where, you know, it's all walkable from the jobs to the housing situations, and instead of spreading out for urban sprawl, the idea being to create quality living that's high density but quality living. And there are models, San Diego I think is supposed to have, you know, something like that, and there was a gentleman that spoke there, and I can't remember what his name is, but there's a book that he's put out on that. And so the design and the models for how to create this balance of affordable housing and being environmentally sensitive is now going to more towards, because of, you know, the population, high density, but high density with quality models of, you know, how the housing is structured, like when they go into old towns and they redevelop it. So there's actually mixed use available, to where there could be apartments above retail spaces or working studio situations for artists and craftsmen, which planning and zoning had not allowed for in the past, which forces urban sprawl if you can't have high density.
Right. Is this another excuse for gentrification? I mean, we see, for example, Salinas uses the Steinbeck Center to clear out all the trashy elements, and San Jose has a
city. We try to do the same. We try to clear out all the,
well,
you know, here.
Yeah, well, I would hope so. I'm intending to leave shortly.
I mean, how would you claim that as gentrification? The people with the big wealth don't want to live in those parts of Salinas, no matter how nice you make the houses. What we're dealing with is, you know, houses, homes that the lot alone, because it's a desirable lot, costs you $1 million to $1.5 million. That's
right. I'm talking about San Francisco more, where they're destroying all the SROs. You see this happening in a lot of cities, and turning them into sort of fancy tourist hotels because it's, you know, it's more cost effective. But what that means is that the people who used to have some alternatives to get off the streets by, you know, cheap rooms don't have that anymore.
Well, that's not Salinas. San Francisco is, you know, a world destination. We're not talking about working people there. I mean, there's a whole other competition for housing and a whole other element of what the style and the type, you know, what the city is and the population, and that's been going on there for many years. I've not really studied it, but I'm somewhat aware of it. And
I think those distinctions you're making are important. Also, I mean, if I were to bring up San Jose, which is even bigger than any of those cities, it too is destroying SROs, you know, gobbling them up and converting them into other uses. But again, that is, of course, you know, the center of
SROs, meaning single room
occupancy hotels, cheap hotels where people can actually live in, you know, that are an alternative to homelessness, because that's one of my main interests, that people who are, you know, in homeless situations are often blamed for their situation, when in fact a lot of it is the housing crisis and the job crisis.
So those were the two major issues, housing and jobs.
Yeah.
And you have the economy of it has to afford the business to be able to give your employees a wage that can afford them to have housing in the same area. So it's bigger than, I mean, you say, you know, well, the employers don't pay much. They're paying shit wages. I try to be one of the business people that's paying $8 to $10 an hour in Santa Cruz and see if there's enough profit in you for you to want to work like that. So I'm not going to blame the employee
or the employer. You are a business person yourself. What kind of business?
Mattress manufacturing. We have employees that have worked with our company over 20 years. We pay way above what national industry standard for our job positions are. And yet to expect our employees to be able to afford housing, it's not really going to happen in terms of buying a home ever. In fact, it's, you know, month to month to try to be able to get by to afford renting a home that would be what you and I would consider a semi-quality lifestyle in the home. Now you go to Las Vegas, for instance, where there's high growth and affordable housing relative to what the pay scales are. I could build a manufacturing plant in Las Vegas and have delivery help that within a couple, and that's not to diminish the value of a delivery person, but that would be, you know, not the management scale of wages, and yet
because they can afford housing,
and they can still afford to buy a home within a couple of years.
And that was Brian and Magnus. Magnus was the man singing about Henry Miller and Marilyn Monroe. Both of them workers at the Henry Miller Memorial Library south of Big Sur. And there's a bit more of that interview, but thought we'd take a brief break and turn to a couple of other things in the nonce. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, just to let you know, in case you just tuned this in as you're tooling along the road. 96.3 FM is our logo numero, and you can call us at 427-3772, 427-FRSC, or 831-427-3772 if you're calling from Portland, Oregon, or Berkeley, California, or Seattle, Washington, or all these places are going to be represented at the Right to Sleep Summit coming up May 3rd and 4th. And for more information about that, give a call to the Huff line at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. It's just a voicemail and actually has very little information about it at the moment. But if you leave your name and number, I'll get back to you, because we're encouraging people to come who want to help end the repression of civil rights with respect to homeless people in Santa Cruz and restore such things as the right to sleep for people who have no choice but to sleep outside. And Berkeley is, for example, featured story in the April 2002 Street Spirit, which, to spare you the trouble of buying it and reading it, I'm going to read it to you now. It's called A New Push for Legal Encampments in Berkeley. The homeless survey found 77% would use a legal campground if available. This is on page 2 of the April edition of Street Spirit. Since last summer, there has been an ongoing discussion of the idea of having a legal encampment in Berkeley. This emerged out of last year's campaign for the right to sleep, which resulted in the negation of the use of the 647J anti-lodging law by Berkeley police, and from the street people hearing about Camp Paradise in Santa Cruz. The Berkeley Homeless Union, the BHU, has been the spearhead of these discussions. The BHU is a revival of a Berkeley group that existed in the late 1980s to 1991 that was involved in Rainbow Village, a vehicular encampment, and in the 10th Street Collective that was involved with encampments and the taking over of buildings, also called squats. Since last spring and into this winter, many illegal encampments and many of the vehicularly housed have been moved by the police out of West Berkeley. The camping ban of Berkeley, which for a long time had been dormant due to the use of the 647J anti-lodging law, has been revived by West Berkeley's police as a way to clear out the vehicularly housed. Last fall, the Berkeley Homeless Union had 3 sleep-out protests against the continued police harassment of those trying to sleep outside. That was 3 more than Santa Cruz had. The first was held on September 12th on the Triangle at Telegraph and Dwight. It was a successful protest with 25 participants. After activists talked to Sergeant Boga, the peace camp was left alone. People were able to speak their mind and sleep in peace more soundly than usual, even with traffic sounds. The second sleepout at the same spot on September 21st, 9 days later, was more problematic. My monitoring skills were tested by the enforcement of the rules, no drugs or alcohol, no violence or fighting. The Southside police, the same ones who have been harassing and arresting people for sleeping, were graciously supportive. It seems even they would like to see more humane solutions to the problem of homelessness. After midnight, Dan McMullen and I, as the main monitors and organizers of the camp, took down the peace camp sign after drunken UC pro-war students made us concerned about our people's safety. Anti-war local activists whose support we had hoped for failed for the most part to materialize. In fact, student anti-war activists pointedly asked the homeless to stay out of their planned sleep-in action on campus. At 4 a.m., a nasty fight broke out and I had to intervene firmly to prevent more serious violence. Discouraged by all this, we in the Berkeley Homeless Union have spent much time discussing the need for internal unity and structure. Ironically, a positive article about the camp out in the Daily Cal, the UC student newspaper, generated a lot of community support for the idea of legal encampments. This helped lessen the negativity around the issue from Rainbow Village and the Albany landfill. Each of those earlier encampments saw violent death and much drug and alcohol abuse, as well as the disappointment of a well-planned proposal for a legal encampment in People's Park in 1990 that became a political hot potato when conservative mayoral challenger Fred Weeks and, quote, progressive, unquote, incumbent Lonnie Hancock both decried the idea. They were forced into a runoff by pro-homeless activist Michael Delacour, who remains supportive. Last August, the BOSS Social Justice Community Organizing Team, the COT, and BOSS is the Berkeley Outreach Support Services, large network of folks concerned with social service organization concerned with the rights and services for the homeless. The community organizing team did an extensive homeless survey on issues involving the human and civil rights of those without housing. We found that 77% of the respondents said they would use a legal campground if it were available, including many living in shelters. On October 30th, 2001, Buna Chima, director of BOSS, came out and said the organization supports legal encampments. She decided to send myself and another community organizing team member to see Dignity Village, a legal encampment up in Portland, Oregon. Berkeley City Councilwoman Linda Mao said if we could come up with a well-thought-out plan, she would seriously consider supporting it. Mayor Shirley Dean spoke out against the idea, but she did say that given the seriousness of the situation depicted in the homeless survey, she would support more housing and shelter. Heavy rains this past winter shifted the Berkeley Homeless Union to focus on getting an emergency winter shelter run by the homeless themselves. In December 2001, Calif Lahut of the Berkeley Homeless Union, the leader of this push, got the whole city council to support having the city staff seriously look into the idea of opening the doors of the old closed Berkeley jail for an emergency winter shelter. How apt. Since day one, the emergency winter shelter down at Oakland Army Base had filled its 50 beds allotted for Berkeley's homeless, and all the other shelters were continually filled. Many homeless people were having an awful time with the continued torrential rains, which also flooded out Santa Cruz's Camp Paradise, hardships which Calif well documented by photo. Despite Calif's and my best efforts at lobbying for the proposed new shelter, opposition from the city staff and local neighbors killed the idea. Instead, 25 beds were added for Berkeley's homeless at the Oakland Army Base's winter shelter. In February 2002, Ryan Hurley and myself of the BOSS community organizing team went up to Oregon to visit Portland's Dignity Village. Inspired by its example, much discussion has occurred in Berkeley on the legal encampment idea. The Berkeley Homeless Union has been looking at campsites to propose to the City Council. On April 16th, the day after the winter shelter closes, and that's also true here in Santa Cruz, I am planning a tour of shame march in West Berkeley to point where the homeless have been ousted, particularly the vehicularly housed, to look at the possible sites and to call attention to the continued need for more housing and shelter for those without either. Bring your sleeping bags or donations of same. But, this is my interjection, don't invite Neil Coonerty because he may have you arrested later on or barred from his bookstore. That's what he did with me, had me barred after sometime after I did a similar march of shame in 1994. The next day, somebody threw a rock through one of Coonerty's windows, the bookshop Santa Cruz owner, who was also on the city council and supporting anti-homeless laws at that time. I have been continuously barred from the bookshop Santa Cruz ever since, even though there's never been any evidence whatsoever that I've had anything to do with that, and I never did. But there can be a lot of heavy prejudice involved if you expose, as Michael Deal is going to be doing on April 16th in Berkeley, the the kinds of shameful behaviors that merchants and social service providers and city bureaucrats engage in when they avoid the basic homeless civil rights issues, or simply remove civil rights for the homeless in order to further business interests. On May 3rd and 4th in Santa Cruz, there will be a summit on the issue of encampments with folks from Berkeley, Portland's Dignity Village, Camp Paradise in Santa Cruz, the new homeless encampment in Isla Vista, and other places. Come join us. And that's what Michael Deal writes as a staff organizer for the BOSS community organizing team. And he gives a phone number up in Berkeley, 510-663-6580, extension 16. And if that was too fast for you, just remember 423-HUFF, 423-H-U-F-F, and give me a call and I'll repeat that number for you at a later time. That's the story about the discussion and protest movement in Berkeley around the right to sleep, which apparently is going to come down here to Santa Cruz to do some talking, and who knows, we may be doing our own tour of shame on April 16th. It's not a bad idea. Today is, what, the 4th, so we have a week or two to think about it. That's the day after the Winter Armory shelter ends, leaving only less than 40 floor spaces on a few church floors for 1,000 to 2,000 homeless people, the rest facing the city's anti-homeless sleeping ban, the law that states between 11 p.m. and 8:30 a.m. you got $54 tickets coming at you, or move on, move out, or hide out. That's the Crone City Council refrain, actually. They are refraining from saying it, but unfortunately it's what the truth of the situation is. So you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. If you want to call in and chat about anything, I'm here to chat with you, and you can just take it from there.
Our problem for only one reason. That president raises the question, who owns the land? The homeless. Our problem for only one reason. Our president raises the question, who owns the land? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Could it be 90 million dead Indians? Who owns the land? Could it be 6 million Jews? Who owns the land? Is there a connection? Who owns the land? To all imperialism, who owns the land? Won't someone please tell me who owns the land? I am just a white man, who owns the land? I live in the Americas, who owns the land? How did I get here? This morning, I was awoken by a man with a handgun. He's got a book of rules that says I ain't got no right to sleep. This morning I was awoken by a man with a handgun. He's got a book of rules that says I ain't.
And interrupting land by 15, we have a call from you.
Hey, this is Dan from Santa Cruz AMC. Wanted to let everyone know, in case you hadn't mentioned it yet, which you might have, I don't know, I just tuned in. The new Camp Paradise, I guess everyone knows that they're set up again?
I know, tell me about it.
You had to have already known.
No, actually, you know, it's interesting. We keep hoping to get more communications from Larry Templeton, but he just doesn't put us in the loop. So put us in the know there, Van of Indie Media, Santa Cruz.
Unfortunately, I haven't gotten him to give me the alerts either. I just had to find out from walking around and digging. But turns out they've got a new Camp Paradise site set up as of 3 weeks ago. It's over there at the Mount Calvary Lutheran Church, just off of Park Avenue, Park Boulevard, something on South Highway 1.
Actually, I thought you meant that they'd moved back into a more public site in the city limits. I had heard about the Mount Calvary site. Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But that's still good news. I'm glad that they've got a place from which they can now operate.
Yeah, so they've got that. They say they've got, like, easy bus access, so they're not as remote from downtown as you might think. Main thing is I took some pictures of the place this morning, and we've got them up on the Santa Cruz IMC site, so if anyone is curious on what the new Camp Paradise 2 actually looks like, pictures are right there. You know, they've only got 12 people so far. You know, they're not, obviously not as large as they used to be, and they haven't finished setting up even half of the tents and infrastructure that they still have left over.
Well, are they inviting people to come? I understood this was a rather limited camp because they're on church property, right?
Dirt Cloud was telling me this morning that they're at 12 people now. They're limiting themselves to 15 total for the time being. He says that because they want to keep the camp from growing too large too quickly before they've built up enough infrastructure to actually support a larger community. Mm-hmm. So once they've got more buildings, more shelters, more this, that, the other thing, a large garden, everything else, whatever it is they're planning, once they have enough to actually support a larger crowd, then he says they'll expand it. But for the time being, they're capping themselves at 15. But he says that was their choice. That was not a limit placed on them by the church.
Yeah, you know, I want to, while we have you on the line, point out that the Santa Cruz Indie Media is the only news media that has broken the story of the, well, I guess you have the lawsuit against the Santa Cruz City Council in federal court posted on your website now?
Yes, we do.
And it's interesting that you do, because that lawsuit, which was filed on March 26th, was completely blacked out by all other media. It didn't get on the television, it didn't get on the radio that I know of, maybe it did, but I didn't hear about it, and it certainly didn't get into the Santa Cruz Sentinel, the San Jose Mercury News, or either of the two weeklies, actually the three weeklies, if you count City on a Hill Press, along with Good Times and the Metro Santa Cruz. Why are you such a radical group that you would dare to put a lawsuit against our city council on the website?
Well, and to play devil's advocate for a moment, the main reason it's up there, the main reason I know about it is because you've been emailing them to me, so I posted it.
So in other words, you allowed me to bully you into putting this on the website?
Yeah, I felt so intimidated. I presume you've emailed it out to pretty much everyone under the sun?
No, not just the lawsuit, but of course press releases and updates on the issue. It has been thoroughly ignored. In fact, Dan White, the reporter for the Santa Cruz Sentinel, showed up on March 26th when we actually, in a dramatic move, I don't know if you were at the city council.
No, I wasn't.
But you may have seen the video, which I think you posted on the web.
Which video?
There's a video of James Ney actually serving the Santa Cruz City Council during the City Council meeting with this unprecedented lawsuit, which demands that they appear in federal court for damages and an injunction against repression of the First Amendment.
Yes, we have that entire video up there because as soon as Becky Johnson emailed out the notice that she had the video, I ran over to her place, got a copy of it, and threw it up online.
Well, you see, that's what...
Again, the only reason we have that is because you and Becky are generating this content for us. Otherwise, we probably would be more clued in than you would be. We're still suffering from a real lack of reporters. We need more people like you guys out there actually bringing us this content, because the two or three of us that are doing it right now, we can only do so much.
Now, is this a call for reporters for Santa Cruz Indie Media?
Oh, we're always calling for reporters. There's 100 times more news going on here than we can keep up with, and we have to let so much slip by us just because we can't handle it. We don't have the bandwidth. We don't have the human bandwidth.
Now, how can people get involved with Santa Cruz Indie Media?
All they need is web access somehow, and then a way to generate content, whatever content that might be. It can be as simple as an ability to type up text talking about something that they've seen, reporting on what they know, or they can upload digital pictures or MP3 audio for like interviews, or they can go as far as doing digital video if they have that ability. It's all just a question of what you know how to do, and if you have a PC or any kind of computer and you're online at all and you just don't know how to do these other mediums of audio and video and photos, just log in and then like ask us, and we'll be happy to tell you, here's how you do it, here's what you grab, here's what you use, here's the software you install, and go crazy with it.
Wow, and then of course if you don't have any of that, but you've just seen the police beating somebody up, or you've seen a merchant harassing someone, or some bizarre behavior one way or the other that you think is publicly noteworthy, you can also call Free Radio Santa Cruz at 427-3772, just like you just did, and you can report it on the air, or if you're a little nervous about that, you can call the voicemail at 427-4523. That's 427-4523, and you can leave a message about it. But it's really important to get this stuff out, because we have not only do we have an unresponsive local monopoly media, the Sentinel, or the Sentinel, as I like to call it, but we have a media that deliberately colludes to cover up stories that are I think, significant. Of course, I would. I'm the one who filed this lawsuit. But as far as I know, this is the first time I've ever heard of any city council being sued in federal court this way for damages. I'm sure it probably has happened, but I don't think it's happened in Santa Cruz. And I haven't heard it's happened anywhere else recently, and certainly not around the issue of repressing homeless protesters at city council or just homeless advocates who are, you know, making a silent motion from the audience, as I did when I gave Mayor Crone the Heil Crone gesture when he cut off a speaker inappropriately in violation of the Brown Act and his council's own rules on March 12th.
Now, you know what? Actually, it might be happening left and right for all we know, because no one reports this stuff.
That's true. That's true. It could be happening. We need some sort of court court check to see if there's any other, you know, cases in the courts. And if anybody's interested in helping with this stuff, I encourage you to give a call to the Huff line at 423-HUFF. We'd love to get you to, you know, join a court watch project, which I guess Chris Fredrickson was a part of, along with old Jeff the Fiddler. I don't know how far it's gotten or where it's at, but try to keep an eye on sleeping band tickets coming into the court. Try to keep an eye on, well, when city councils are finally getting their just desserts in court and hauled into court. And it's something that, you know, as you point out, like other news stories, it needs person power to push.
Yeah, it does. Oh, one more thing I would like to point out, too. For people, if they don't even have a computer, or if they do but they have no ability to get to the Internet at all, that's fine. Cruise.io offers public access terminals during regular business hours right there in their front lobby. So you could just waltz on down in there and use one of their terminals and go over to our site, which, if anyone doesn't know, it's santacruz.indymedia.org. Just go over there to our site and go over, click on the publish button and fill out the form, you know, title, subject, summary, text, explain what you saw, and then it's hit publish, and boom, it's up there. Don't even need your own computer.
santacruz.indymedia.org. And again, the Cruzio office is where?
It's on Pacific. It's down towards the end, like about it's right across from Public Access Television, if you know where that is. It's about a block from...
It's near the subway, the subway restaurant on the corner, if people know where that is. It's about three or four storefronts down from that. I hadn't known that Cruzio had that, you know, facility, and that's interesting.
Yeah, last time I was down there, they still seem to be offering it. They're pretty cool like that.
Yeah, so you see something, rush into Cruzio and quickly write up the story for santacruz.indymedia.org, and you too can be Reporter of the Week, or at least put out information to the community that we need to know and might not otherwise hear about.
Yep.
Hey, thank you there.
No problem.
Alrighty.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
So, phone lines are open here at beautiful Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3, and that number is 427-3772, 427-FRSC. There's good news and bad news on that law front suit. Again, that's the lawsuit front. There we go. On the lawsuit front, the good news is that some may remember who tuned in last week. I was arrested at City Council for silently protesting Mayor Crone's bullying behavior, and also, I would say, betrayal of his own rules, but mainly his betrayal of the public interest and the public right to have an unimpeded oral communications period at the March 12th City Council meeting. And I didn't really do much. I didn't stand up and harangue the crowd. I didn't disrupt things in any way. I just simply raised my hand very briefly to indicate I thought that they were all behaving like fascists, and then turned to the person next to me, began to talk to her. And for that, I was ordered out of the room. I said, nope. They had me arrested, taken away in handcuffs, held in jail for 5.5 hours, and charged with disrupting a public assembly. That's a misdemeanor charge, and after finally 3 weeks, well, I went to the police station to try to get my police report, because I needed to determine if it's Mayor Crone that filed a citizen's complaint for my arrest, Councilmember Fitzmaurice, who knows, somebody else that I've never heard of from the back row. I mean, someone was claiming that a silent gesture is disrupting a city council meeting, which of course is ridiculous and is a false report. That's the kind of thing that that person becomes criminally liable for. And I don't just mean civilly liable, I mean criminally liable. It is a crime to file a false report. Now, the DA may not prosecute it, but you have the right as another citizen, if you're being arrested, to go to the citizen who's arresting you, to go to the police officer who's arresting you, because that police officer has a duty to at least make you sign a ticket. That's what's called taking you into custody. And then the police officer, you know, I suppose can make a decision to keep you in handcuffs, as Butchie Baker seems to like doing with me. He's done it on 3 occasions on minor offenses. But he can usually, with a citizen's arrest, you release the person and they have to appear in court at a court date. But you can, at the moment you are arrested, you can say to the officer, I'll be happy to sign this citation, but I'm also going to file a citizen's, I want a citizen's arrest made of the individual who's arresting me for making a false report. That's if it is a false report. I mean, if there's a real dispute, I mean, a false report doesn't mean the guy's mistaken. A false report means that the individual who's having you arrested is actually malicious and lying about it, or is acting in such disregard of the facts that there's no probable cause to believe that the crime that this person alleges has actually happened. And that, of course, was the case at City Council on March 12th. There was no probable cause whatsoever that I was disrupting the City Council meeting. I was simply disobeying the chair of the meeting. My crime was not bowing low enough, not spreading my legs wide enough, not being afraid enough, not essentially shutting up fast enough and fully enough, and in essence, not leaving the chamber. Not bending over for this kind of thing. I use these graphic and rather rude analogies because they really describe what's happening to people if they follow City Council directions under these circumstances. Because you as a member of the public, however foolish it may be for you to come to City Council meetings in terms of your ability, lack of ability to actually influence any of their deliberations, you still have a right to do that. That is the legislative center in the city of Santa Cruz, just as the Board of Supervisors is in the county, just as the state legislature is in the state, and of course the federal legislature is in the national scene. So you have a right to be there, and for the city council, or any member of the city council, to intimidate you into leaving by threatening to have you arrested for engaging in legal conduct, even to threaten to have you arrested, to me is not only a betrayal of the public trust, but it's probably criminal behavior. It's a kind of assault, because to put you in fear of your safety, because that's what happens if a police officer is going to come and take you away, and you know you don't know what he's going to do. You are in a position where you know you wish to retain your rights. I mean, one would think you'd be within your rights to in essence resist an unlawful arrest, and that's another matter.